It had been 5 years since I had first joined the secret world, and now, after 3 frantic days in Moscow, everything was on the line. For 2 hours, we drove without leaving the confines of the electrified fence, coming to a stop at last at a lonely ranch house surrounded by a parched lawn. Restricted to 2 small rooms and forbidden any contact except with my interrogators, I knew that in another wing of the house, 12 forensic teams would be going through my life with a fine-toothed comb, the writers too, trying to find the footprints of the truth. I also knew how they'd interview me. But no amount of practice sessions during training can prepare you for the reality of being worked over by hostile interrogators. 4 teams worked in shifts. And I say it without editorial comment, purely as a matter of record. The women were the worst, or the best, depending on your point of view. The shapeliest of them appeared to think that by leaving the top of her shirt undone and leaning forward, she would somehow get closer to the truth. Wonderbra, I called her. It would be the same sort of method used years later with great effect on the Muslim detainees at Guantanamo Bay. I understood the theory. It was a reminder of the world you hungered for, the world of pleasure, far removed from the place of constant anxiety. All you had to do was cooperate. And let me just say, it works. Hammered about details night and day as they search for any discrepancy, you're tired, weary to the bone. 2 weeks of it, and you're longing for another world, any world. Late one night, after 12 hours without pause, I asked Wonderbra, "You figure I planned it all, and I shot him on the edge of Red Square. Red Square. Why would I do that?"
"Stupid, I guess," she said evenly.
"Where did they recruit you, Hooters?" I yelled. For the first time, I'd raised my voice. It was a mistake. Now the teams of analysts and psychologists watching via the hidden cameras would know they were getting to me. Instantly, I hoped she would return service, but she was a professional. She kept her voice calm, just leaned even further forward, the few buttons on her shirt straining.
"They're natural, and it's no credit to the bra, in case you're wondering. What song was the carousel playing?"
I forced the anger to walk away. "I've already told you."
"Tell us again."
"Smells like teen spirit." "I'm serious, this is modern Russia, nothing makes sense."
"You've heard it before?" she said.
"Of course I've heard it before, it's Nirvana."
"In the square, I mean, when you scouted locations?"
"There was no scouting, because there was no plan," I told her quietly, a headache starting in my left temple. When they finally let me go to bed, I felt she was winning. No matter how innocent you are, that's a bad thing to think when you're in an isolated house, clinging to your freedom, as good as lost to the world. Early the next morning, Wednesday by my figuring, but in fact a Saturday, that's how disoriented I'd become. The door to my sleeping area was unlocked, and the handler hung a clean set of clothes on the back of it. He spoke for the first time and offered me a shower instead of the normal body wash in a basin in the corner. I knew this technique too. Make me think they were starting to believe me, encourage me to trust them. But by this stage, I was pretty well past caring about the psychology of it all. Like Freud might have said, sometimes a shower's still a shower. The handler unlocked a door into an adjoining bathroom and left. It was a white room, clinical, ring bolts in the ceiling and walls that hinted at a far darker purpose, but I didn't care. I shaved, undressed, and let the water flood down. As I was getting dry, I caught sight of myself naked in a full-length mirror and stopped. It was strange. I hadn't really looked at myself for a long time. I'd lost about 20 pounds in the 3 weeks or whatever it was I'd been at the ranch, and I couldn't remember ever seeing my face look more haggard. It made me appear a lot older, and I stared at it for a time, as if it were a window into the future. I wasn't ugly. I was tall, and my hair was salted with blonde thanks to the European summer. With the extra pounds stripped off my waist and butt thanks to the investigation, I was in good shape. Not with the 6-pack ab vanity of a movie star, but with the fitness that came from practicing 40 minutes of Krav Maga every day. In Israeli system of self-defense, it is, according to people who know, the most highly regarded form of unarmed combat among New York drug dealers north of 140th Street. I always figured if it was good enough for the professionals, it was good enough for me. One day, several years in the future, alone and desperate, it would save my life. As I stood close to the mirror, taking inventory of the man I saw before me, wondering if I really liked him that much, it occurred to me I might not be the only one watching. Wonderbra and her friends were probably on the other side of the glass, conducting their own appraisal. I may not be on top of anyone's list for male lead in Deep Throat 2, but I didn't have anything to be ashamed of. No, it wasn't that which made me angry. It was the intrusion into every part of my life. The endless search for evidence that did not exist, the soul-destroying conviction that nobody could do something simply because they thought it was right. Krav Maga instructors will tell you that the mistake most people make when they fight is to punch someone's head really hard. The first thing you break is your knuckles. For that reason, a real professional clenches his or her fist and uses the side of it like a hammer hitting an anvil. A blow like that from a reasonably fit person will deliver, according to the instructors, over 4 newtons of force at the point of impact. You can imagine what that does to someone's face. Or to a mirror. It split into pieces and shattered on the floor. The most surprising thing was the wall behind. It was bare. No two-way glass, nothing. I stared at it, wondering if I was the one that was cracking. Showered and shaved, I returned to the bedroom and, dressed in the clean clothes, I sat on the bed and waited. Nobody came. I went to bang on the door and found that it was unlocked. Oh, this was cute, I thought. The trust quotient was going suborbital now. Either that, or in this particular episode of The Twilight Zone, I would find the house was empty and hadn't been lived in for years. I made my way to the living room. I had never been in it before, but that's where I found the whole team, about 40 of them smiling at me. For an awful moment, I thought they were going to clap. The team leader, a guy with a face made out of spare parts, said something I barely understood. Then Wonderbra was putting out her hand, saying it was just work, hoping there were no hard feelings. I was about to suggest she come upstairs where I'd visit on her acts of violence, some of them increasingly sexual in nature, but what the team leader said now made me stop. I decided such thoughts were unworthy of someone who had received a handwritten letter from the President of the United States. It was lying on a table, and I sat down to read it. Under the impressive blue and gold seal, it said that a complete and thorough investigation had cleared me of all wrongdoing. The President thanked me for what he called great courage, above and beyond the call of duty. In hostile territory, far removed from help or safety, and facing the need for immediate action, you did not hesitate or give any thought to your personal welfare, he wrote. He said that while it was impossible for the public ever to know of my actions, both he personally and the country at large were deeply grateful for the service I had performed. Somewhere in it, he also used the word hero. I walked to the door. I felt the assembled eyes on me, but I hardly noticed. I went out and stood on the lawn, looking across the bleak landscape. Cleared of all wrongdoing, the letter had said. And as I thought on that, and the other word he had used, it unchained a host of emotions in me. I wondered what Bill and Grace would have thought. Would they have found the pride in me I had so long denied them? I heard a car's tires crunch up the long gravel drive and stop at the front of the house, but I ignored it. And what of the dead woman in Detroit, the one with the same startling blue eyes as mine? She had loved me, I was sure of that, but it was strange given that I hardly knew her. What would my mother feel if I could have told her? I kept standing there, shoulders hunched against the wind and the emotional debris swirling around me, until I heard a door open. I turned. The team leader and Wonderbra were standing on the porch. With them was an elderly man, just arrived in the car, whom I had known for a long time. It doesn't matter what his name was. By design, nobody has ever heard of him. He was the director of the division. Slowly, he came down the steps and stood with me.
You read the letter?
He asked. I nodded. He put his hand on my arm and exerted a tiny pressure, his way of saying thank you. I guess he knew that any words of his would have little hope of competing with that blue and gold seal. He followed my gaze across the bleak landscape and spoke of the man I had killed.
If you take the final betrayal out of it,
he said,
he was a fine agent, one of the best.
I stared at him. That's one way of putting it, I replied. If you take the bomb out of it, 6th August was probably a nice day in Hiroshima.
Jesus, Eddie. I'm doing my best here. I'm trying to find something positive. He was a friend of mine.
Mine too, Director, I said flatly.
I know, Eddie,
he replied, restraining himself. Amazing what a letter from the President can do.
I've said a dozen times I'm glad it was you, not me. Even when I was younger, I don't know if I could have done it.
I didn't say anything. From what I had heard, he would have taken a machine gun to Disneyland if he had thought it would have advanced his career. He turned his collar up against the wind and told me he wanted me to return to London.
I've checked with everyone who has to sign off. The decision was unanimous. I'm appointing you the new writer of the blue.
I said nothing, just stared across the blighted fields for a long time, saddened beyond telling by the circumstances and those two little girls. I was 29 years old, and the youngest writer of the blue there had ever been. Chapter 8. London had never looked more beautiful than the night I flew in. St. Paul's Cathedral, the Houses of Parliament, and all the other old citadels of power and grandeur standing like sculptures against a red and darkening sky. It was less than 20 hours since my promotion, and I had traveled without rest. I was wrong about the location of the ranch house. It was in the Black Hills of South Dakota, even more remote than I had imagined. From there, it was a 2-hour drive to the nearest public airport, where a private jet had flown me to New York to connect with a British Airways transatlantic flight. A Ford SUV, 3 years old and splashed with dirt to make it look unremarkable, picked me up at Heathrow and took me into Mayfair. It was a Sunday night, and there was little traffic, but even so, progress was slow. The vehicle was armor-plated, and the extra weight made it a bitch to drive. The guy wrestling the wheel finally turned into a cul-de-sac near South Audley Street, and the garage door of an elegant townhouse swung up. We drove into the underground garage of a building which, according to the brass plaque on the front door, was the European headquarters of the Balearic Islands Investment Trust. A sign underneath told the public that appointments could be made only by telephone. No number was given, and if anyone ever checked, London Directory Assistance had no listing for it. Needless to say, nobody ever called. I took the elevator from the basement to the top floor and entered what had always been the Writer of the Blue's office, a large expanse of polished wood floors and white sofas, but no windows or natural light. The building itself had a concrete core, and it was from this cell within a cell that I began trying to unravel my predecessor's web of deceit. Late into that first night, I called secret phone numbers which telephone companies didn't even know they hosted, assembling a special team of cryptographers, analysts, archivists, and field agents. Despite what governments might claim, not all wars are fought with embedded reporters or in the glare of 24-hour news cameras. The following day, the new writer and his small group of partisans launched their own campaign across Europe, doing battle with what turned out to be the most serious penetration of the U.S. intelligence community since the Cold War. We had some major successes, but even though, as time passed, enemy bodies started piling up like cordwood, I still couldn't sleep. One night, chasing down a stale lead in Prague, I walked for hours through the old city and forced myself to take stock of where we were. By my own standards, shorn of all complications, I had failed. After 20 months' unremitting work, I still hadn't discovered the method by which the Russians were paying the agents of ours. The traitors, in other words, they had corrupted. The money trail remained as mysterious as ever, and unless we could track it successfully, we would never know how far the plumes of infection had spread. As a result, I resolved to throw everything we had at the problem, but in the end, none of that mattered. It was a shy forensic accountant and a dose of serendipity that came to our rescue. Plowing one last time through the mountain of material seized from my predecessor's London home before it vanished into the division's archives, the accountant found a handwritten grocery list stuck in the back of a checkbook. About to throw it away, he turned it over and saw it was written on the back of a blank FedEx consignment docket. Strange, because none of our investigations had shown any evidence of a FedEx account. Intrigued, he called the company and discovered a list of pickups from the address, all of which had been paid for in cash. Only one turned out to be of interest. A box of expensive Cuban cigars sent to the luxurious Burj Al Arab Hotel in Dubai. It quickly transpired that the name of the recipient on the FedEx docket was fake, and that would have been an end to the matter, except for the moment of serendipity. A woman working with the accountant had once been a travel agent, and she knew that all hotels in the United Arab Emirates are required to take a copy of every guest's passport. I called the hotel under the guise of an FBI special agent attached to Interpol and convinced the manager to examine their files and give me the passport details of the guest who had been staying in Suite 1608 on the relevant date. It turned out to be a person called Christos Nikolaidis. It was an elegant name. Shame about the man. Chapter 9. Everyone agreed on one thing. Christos would have been handsome if it weren't for his height. The olive skin, wave of unruly dark hair and good teeth couldn't overcome legs that were far too short for his body. But money probably helped, especially with the women he liked to run with, and Christos Nikolaidis certainly had plenty of that. A flurry of police database searches showed that he was the real deal, a genuine lowlife with no convictions, but a significant involvement in 3 murders and a host of other crimes of violence. 31 years old and a Greek national, he was the eldest son of uneducated parents who lived outside Thessaloniki, in the north of the country. It's important to stress uneducated here, as opposed to stupid, which they most certainly were not. In the following weeks, as we delved deeper into his life, the family became increasingly interesting. A close-knit clan of brothers, uncles, and cousins, the family was headed by Christos's 60-year-old father, Patros, the family's ruthless enforcer. As they say in Athens, he had a thick jacket, a long criminal record, but this had been accompanied by great material success. An adjustment to the orbit of a U.S. satellite monitoring the Balkans provided photos showing the family's compound in stunning detail. Set amid rolling acres of lavender, the complex of 7 luxurious homes, swimming pools, and lavish stables was surrounded by a 12-foot wall patrolled by what we believe to be Albanians armed with Scorpion machine pistols. This was strange, given that the family was in the wholesale floristry business. Maybe flower theft was a bigger problem in northern Greece than most people realized. We theorized that, like Colombia's Medellin cartel before them, they had adapted the complex high-speed air and road network needed to transport a perishable product like flowers to include a far more profitable commodity. But what did a family of Greek drug dealers have to do with my predecessor? And why would he be sending the eldest son a box of cigars at a 7-star hotel in the Middle East? It was possible the former writer had had a drug habit, and Christos was his dealer, but it didn't make much sense. The Greeks were definitely on the wholesale side of the business. I was about to dismiss the whole investigation as another dead end, maybe Christos and my predecessor were nothing more than friendly scumbags, when by good luck I could not get to sleep on a grim London night. I looked across the rooftops from my apartment in Belgravia, thinking of how the 2 men probably ate together at one of the area's Michelin-starred restaurants, when I realized that the answer to our most difficult problem might be staring me in the face. What if the Russians weren't responsible for paying our rogue agents at all? Say Christos Nikolaidis and his family were responsible for making the payments. Why? Because they were running drugs into Moscow, and that was the contribution they had to make to the cash-strapped Russians for the license to do so. Call it a business tax. It meant the Greeks would be using their black cash and money laundering skills to transfer funds from their own accounts into ones in the names of our traders. And the Russian intelligence agencies wouldn't show up anywhere near the process. Under such a scenario, somebody who had received a large payment, the writer of the blue, might send an expensive box of cigars to the man who had just paid him, Christos Nikolaidis, on vacation in Dubai. I put all thoughts of sleep aside, went back into the office, and launched an intense investigation, with the help of the Greek government, into the Nikolaidis family's deeply subterranean financial arrangements. It was information discovered during this process that led me to Switzerland, in the quiet streets of Geneva. Despite the city's reputation for cleanliness, it's a dirty little town if I've ever seen one. Chapter 10. The offices of the world's most secretive private bank lie behind an anonymous limestone facade in the center of Geneva's Quartier des Banques. There is no name displayed, but Clément Richelieu and C. has occupied the same building for 200 years, counting among its clients countless African despots, numerous corporate criminals, and the rich descendants of a few prominent members of the Third Reich. Richelieu's was also the Greek family's bankers, and, as far as I could see, offered our only way forward. They would have to be persuaded to give us a list of the Nikolaidis family's transactions over the last 5 years, documents which would show if Christos was acting as the Russians' paymaster and, if so, which Americans were on the payroll. Of course, we could make an application in court, but Richelieu's would claim, correctly, that it was illegal to divulge any information because of the Swiss government's banking secrecy laws, legalization which had made the nation a favorite with tyrants and criminals. It was for this reason that I contacted the bank as the Monaco-based lawyer for interests associated with the Paraguayan military, and arrived on their marble doorstep prepared to discuss a range of highly confidential financial matters. Carrying an attaché case full of forged documents, and the prospect of what seemed to be deposits worth hundreds of millions of dollars, I sat in a conference room full of faux antiques and waited for the bank's managing partner. The meeting turned out to be one of the most memorable events of my professional life. Not because of Christos Nikolaidis, but thanks to a lesson I learned. My education started with the opening of the oak-paneled door. It is fair to say a lot of my work has been a row through a sewer in a glass-bottom boat, but even by those low standards, Marcus Boucher was memorable. Despite being a lay preacher at Geneva's austere Calvinist cathedral, he was, like most of his profession, up to his armpits in blood and shit. Now in his 50s, you could say he'd hit a home run. A big estate in Cologne, overlooking the lake, a Bentley in the garage, but given that he had started on second base, it wasn't really much of an achievement. His family were the largest shareholders in the privately held bank. He made a big deal of the fact that the room we were in was soundproof to American intelligence agency standards, but failed to mention the hidden camera I had registered in the frame of a portrait on the wall. It was positioned to look over a client's shoulder and record any documents they might be holding. Just to be bloody-minded, I casually rearranged the chairs so that all the lens could see was the back of my briefcase. Amateurs, I thought. As Boucher worked his way through the forgeries, probably mentally tallying the management fees they could earn on such huge sums, I looked at my watch. 3 minutes to 1, almost lunchtime. Unfortunately for the Nikolaidis family, they had overlooked one salient point as they funneled more and more money into Richelieu's. Boucher's only child had also entered the banking trade. 23, and without much experience of men or the world, she was working in the more respectable end of the business, for Credit Suisse in Hong Kong. I glanced at my watch again. 2 minutes to 1. I leaned forward and quietly told Boucher, I wouldn't know anybody in the Paraguayan military from a fucking hole in the ground. He looked at me, confused. Then he laughed, thinking this was an American version of humor. I assured him it wasn't. I gave him Christos's full name, what I believed to be his account number, and said I wanted a copy of the banking records concerning him, his family, and their associated companies for the last 5 years. In a dark corner of my mind, I was hoping I was right about this, or there would be hell to pay, but there was no going back now. Boucher got to his feet, righteous indignation swelling in his breast, blustering about people gaining entry by false pretenses, that he had immediately recognized the documents as forgeries, how only an American would think that a Swiss banker would divulge such information even if he had it. He came towards me, and I realized I was being given the singular honor denied to so many dictators and mass murderers. I was going to be thrown out of a Swiss bank. It was 1 o'clock. He paused, and I saw his eyes flick to his desk. His private cell phone, lying with his papers, the number he believed known only to his close family, was vibrating. I watched in silence as he stole a glance at the caller's number. Deciding to deal with it later, he turned and bore down on me, wearing his outrage like body armor. "It's 8 o'clock at night in Hong Kong," I said, without shifting in my chair, ready to break his arm if he tried to touch me. "What?" he snapped back, not really comprehending. "In Hong Kong," I said more slowly. "It's already late." I saw a flash of fear in his eyes as he grasped what I had said. He looked at me, questions flooding in he couldn't answer. How the hell did I know it was Hong Kong calling? He turned and grabbed the phone. I kept my eyes fixed on him as he heard that not only was I right about it being Hong Kong, but that his daughter, fighting to keep the panic out of her voice, told him she was confronting a major problem. It may have only been lunchtime in Geneva, but for Marcus Boucher, the day was growing darker by the second. It seemed that, 2 hours earlier, all communications within his daughter's luxury high-rise had suffered a major failure. Phone, cable TV, Wi-Fi, high-speed DSL had all gone down. A dozen crews from Hong Kong Telecom had started trying to find the fault. One of these maintenance crews, 3 men, all wearing regulation white boiler suits and necklace ID cards, had found their way into Claire Boucher's apartment. By the time she called her father, she was of the view that they were not, perhaps, what they claimed to be. Her first piece of evidence was that 2 of them didn't seem to speak any Chinese at all. In fact, they sounded like Americans. The second clue concerned communications equipment. Although she didn't know much about such things, she was pretty sure you didn't need a NATO-style 9mm Beretta pistol fitted with a silencer to fix a line fault. I watched her father's face turn an unhealthy shade of gray as she explained her situation. He looked up at me with a mixture of pure hatred and desperation.
"Who are you?"
he said, so quiet as to be almost inaudible.
"From what I've overheard," I said, "I'm the only person in the world who can help you. By good fortune, the head of Hong Kong Telecom owes me a favor. Let's just say I helped him bid for a successful phone contract in Paraguay."
I thought at that moment he was going to hurl himself at me, so I got ready to hurt him badly if necessary and kept talking. "I'm certain in the right circumstances I could call and ask him to have the technicians look elsewhere." Somehow, Boucher managed to master himself. He looked at me, deeper now in the forest than he had ever thought possible, at a crossroads that would determine the rest of his life. I watched the battle rage on his face. He could no more abandon his daughter than he could violate everything he thought he stood for. He was paralyzed, and I had to help him make the right decision. Like I mentioned, it was a terrible morning. "If I could just say this, if you decide not to cooperate and the technicians have to eliminate your daughter, I can't influence what they might do to her beforehand, if you understand. It's out of my power." I didn't like to use the word rape, not to a father. He said nothing, then turned aside and vomited on the floor. He wiped his mouth on his sleeve and got shakily to his feet.
"I'll get the records," he said, lurching forward.
People say love is weak, but they're wrong. Love is strong. In nearly everyone, it trumps all other things, patriotism and ambition, religion and upbringing. And of every kind of love, The epic and the small, the noble and the base. The one that a parent has for their child is the greatest of them all. That was a lesson I learned that day, and I'll be forever grateful I did. Some years later, deep in the ruins called the Theater of Death, it salvaged everything. By the time I grabbed his arm, Boucher was already halfway to the door, willing to surrender anything, desperate to save his daughter. "Stop," I told him. He turned to me, close to tears.
"You think I'll call the police?" he shouted. "Was your technician still in her apartment?"
"Of course not," I said. "You're not a fool."
"So let me get the records, for Christ's sake."
"What's to stop you giving me phony ones or another client's?" "No, we'll go and look at the computer together." He shook his head, panicking.
"Impossible. Nobody's allowed in the back office. The staff will realize."
It was true, except for one thing. "Why do you think I chose 1 o'clock, the Friday of a holiday weekend?" I said. "Everybody's at lunch." I picked up my bag, followed him out of the conference room, and watched as he used an encrypted ID card to unlock a door into the inner offices. We sat at a terminal. He used a fingerprint scanner to open the system and keyed in the digits of an account number. There they were, pages of Christos Nikolaidis' supposedly secret bank records, linked to a matrix of other family accounts. Within minutes, we were printing them all out. I stared at the pages for a long time, the ledgers of so much corruption and death. The family were billionaires, or close enough not to matter, but the records also proved beyond doubt that Christos was the Russians' paymaster. More than that, just as I'd hoped, the documents also prized open the rest of the enterprise. Regular transfers into other accounts at the bank revealed the names of 6 of our people whom I would never have imagined were traitors. 2 of them were FBI agents involved in counter-espionage, and the other 4 were career diplomats at U.S. embassies in Europe, including a woman I had once slept with, and for what they had done, there was usually only 1 tariff. In a corner of my heart, I hoped they would get good lawyers and manage to plea bargain it down to life imprisonment. Don't believe what they tell you. It's a terrible thing to hold another person's life in the palm of your hand. So it was with less satisfaction than I had anticipated that I put the material in my briefcase and turned to Boucher. I told him that in 2 hours I would call the head of Hong Kong Telecom and have the technicians reassigned. I stood up and, under the circumstances, decided against offering him my hand. Without a word, I walked out, leaving him alone, vomit smearing his suit, 1 hand trembling, trying to decide if the palpitations he could feel in his chest were just nerves or something far more serious. I didn't know if the man would ever recover, and maybe I would have felt some sympathy for him, except for a strange event which occurred in my childhood. Accompanied by Bill Murdoch, I had made a trip to a small French village called Rottau on the German border. 20 years and countless adventures have passed, but in a way, part of me has never left that place. Or maybe I should say part of it has never left me. Chapter 11. If you ever find yourself in the part of the world where France and Germany meet and want your heart broken, drive up the twisting road from the village, through the pine forests and into the foothills of the Vosges Mountains. Sooner or later, you will come to an isolated place called Natzweiler Struthof. It was a Nazi concentration camp, almost forgotten now, never making it on to the misery with a guidebook tours like Auschwitz and Dachau. You come out of the pine trees, and at an intersection there is a simple country road sign. 1 way points to a local bar, and the other to the gas chamber. No, I'm not kidding. Tens of thousands of prisoners pass through the camp's gates, but that's not the worst thing. The worst thing is hardly anybody has ever heard of it. That amount of grief just isn't big enough to register on the Richter scale of the 20th century. Another way of measuring progress, I suppose. I was 12 when I went there. It was summer vacation, and as usual, Bill and Grace had taken a suite at the George V Hotel in Paris for most of August. They were both interested in art. She liked old masters that told people entering the house that this was a woman of wealth and taste. Bill, thank God, was out on the edge, dancing on the edge half the time. He was never happier than when he was finding some new gallery or wandering around a young kid's studio. Grace, completely disinterested, had long ago forbidden him to hang any of his purchases, and Bill would wink at me and say,
"She's right. Whatever it is, you can't call it art. I call it charity. Some people give to the United Way. I support starving artists."
But beneath all the jokes, he knew what he was doing.
Years later, I realized what an expert eye he had, which was strange, given that he was completely untrained and his family's only interest had been chemicals. His mother's name, before she married, had been DuPont. The second week we were in Paris, Bill got a call from a guy in Strasbourg who said he had a sheaf of drawings by Robert Rauschenberg, dating from when the great pop artist was an unknown marine. The next day, Bill and I got in a plane with a bag packed for the weekend, leaving Grace to indulge her second great passion, shopping at Hermes. And so it was, once Bill had bought the drawings, that we found ourselves in Strasbourg on a Sunday with nothing to do.
"I thought we might go out to the Vosges Mountains," he said. "Grace would probably say you're too young, but there's a place you should see. Sometimes life can seem difficult, and it's important to keep things in perspective."
Bill knew about Natzweiler Struthof because of his father. He'd been a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. 6th Army that had campaigned across Europe. The colonel had arrived at the camp just after the SS abandoned it, and he was given the job of writing a report that found its way to the War Crimes Tribunal in Nuremberg. I don't know if Bill had ever read his father's document, but he found the twisting road without any trouble, and we pulled into the car park just before noon, a brilliant summer's day. Slowly, we walked into Death's house. The camp had been preserved as a French historic site because so many members of the resistance had died there. Bill pointed out the old hotel outbuilding the Germans had converted into a gas chamber, and a crematorium packed with body elevators and ovens. For one of the few times in my life, I held his hand. We passed the gallows used for public executions, the building where they had conducted medical experiments, and came to Prisoner Barracks Number 1, which housed a museum. Inside, among the prisoners' old uniforms and diagrams of the concentration camp system, we got separated. In a quiet corner at the back, near a row of bunk beds where the surrounding ghosts seemed even more tangible, I found a photo displayed on a wall. Actually, there were a lot of photos of the Holocaust, but this was the one that has never left me. It was in black and white, and it showed a short, stocky woman walking down a wide path between towering electrified fences. By the look of the light, it was late in the afternoon, and in the language of those times, she was dressed like a peasant. By chance, there were no guards, no dogs, no watchtowers in the photo, though I'm sure they were there. Just a lonely woman with a baby in her arms, and her other two children holding tight to her skirt. Stoic, unwavering, supporting their tiny lives, helping them as best as any mother could, she walked them towards the gas chamber. You could almost hear the silence, smell the terror. I stared at it, both uplifted and devastated by the stark image of a family and a mother's endless love. A small voice inside, a child's voice, kept telling me something I've never forgotten. I would have such as to have known her. Then a hand fell on my shoulder. It was Bill come to find me. I could see from his eyes he'd been crying. Overwhelmed, he indicated the piles of shoes and small items such as hairbrushes that the inmates had left behind.
"I didn't realize how powerful ordinary things can be," he said.
Finally, we walked up a path inside the old electrified fence towards the exit gates. As we wound our way up, he asked me,
"Did you see the part about the gypsies?"
I shook my head. "No."
"They lost even more in percentage terms than the Jews."
"I didn't know that,"
I said, trying to be grown up.
"Nor did I,"
he replied.
"They don't call it the Holocaust, the gypsies. In their language, they have another name for it. They call it the Devouring."
We walked the rest of the way to the car in silence, and flew back to Paris that night. By some unspoken agreement, we never mentioned to Grace where we had been. I think we both knew she would never have understood. Months later, a couple of nights before Christmas, I walked down the stairs at the quiet house in Greenwich and was stopped by voices raised in anger.
$5 million? Grace was saying incredulously. Still, you do what you like, I suppose. It's your money.
Damn right it is, he agreed.
The accountant says it's going to an orphanage in Hungary, she said. That's another thing I don't understand. What do you know about Hungary?
Not much. Apparently, it's where a lot of gypsies came from. It's a gypsy orphanage, he said, more or less evenly. She looked at him like he was crazy.
Gypsies? Gypsies?
Then they turned and saw me watching from the doorway. Bill's eyes met mine, and he knew that I understood. Poramos, as the gypsies say in Romani. The devouring. After that Christmas, I enrolled at Caulfield Academy, a really phony high school that took pride in providing every student with the means to lead a fulfilling life. Given the staggering fees, that aspect was probably already taken care of. You had to have about 6 generations of blue chips behind you even to get in the gate. The second week I was there, we were doing a course to improve our skills at public speaking. Only Caulfield Academy could dream up classes like that. The topic someone picked out of a hat was motherhood, and we spent 30 minutes listening to guys talk about what their moms had done for them, which was probably nothing, and funny stuff that happened at the villa in the south of France. Then I got called on. So I stood up, pretty nervous, and started telling them about pine trees in summer and the long road up into the mountains. And I tried to explain this photo I'd seen and how I knew the mother loved her kids more than anything in the world, and there was this book I'd read by somebody whose name I couldn't remember, and he had this expression, sorrow floats. And that's what I felt about the photo. And I was trying to tie all this together when people started laughing and asking what I was smoking. And even the teacher, who was a young chick who thought she was sensitive but wasn't, told me to sit down and stop rambling on and maybe I should think twice before I ran for high elective office. And that made everybody laugh even louder. I never got up to speak in class after that. Not in the 5 years I was at Caulfield. No matter what amount of trouble it caused. It made people say I was a loner. There was something dark about me, and I guess they were right. How many of them adopted the secret life, or ended up killing half as many people as I did? Here's the strange thing, though. Through all that difficulty in the passage of 20 years, time hasn't dimmed my memory of that photo. It has only made it sharper. It lies in wait for me just before I go to sleep, and try as I might, I've never been able to get it out of my head. Chapter 12. I was thinking of it once again as I walked out of the front doors of Clément Richelieu and C and into the Geneva sunshine. Sure, I could have felt some sympathy for Marcus Boucher and his daughter, but I couldn't help remembering that it was Swiss bankers like Boucher and his family who would help fund and support the Third Reich. I have no doubt the mother in the photo and millions of other families in cattle cars would have gladly traded the Bouchers' couple of hours of discomfort for what they eventually got. It was just like Bill had said all those years ago. It's important to keep things in perspective. Thinking about the dark history that clung to so much of Geneva's hidden wealth, I walked to the Rue du Rhône, turned right, stopped near the entrance to the old town, and made an encrypted call on my cell phone to a Greek island. The bank ledgers in the briefcase, which was now handcuffed to my wrist, were Christos Nikolaidis' death warrant. And in the world in which I dwelt, there were no appeals and no last-minute stays of execution. As it turned out, killing him wasn't a mistake. But the way I did it certainly was. There were 5 assassins, 3 men and 2 women, waiting for my call on Santorini. With its azure harbor, achingly white houses rimming cliffs, and donkeys shuttling visitors up to jewel-box boutiques, it is the most beautiful of all the Greek islands. Dressed in chinos and capri pants, the team was invisible among the thousands of tourists who visit the island every day. The weapons were in their camera cases. Months before, as the mysterious Nicolaides family had moved ever more clearly into our sights, we had taken an interest in a former icebreaker called the Arctic Inn. Registered in Liberia, the 300-foot boat, capable of withstanding just about any kind of attack, had been converted at huge expense into a luxury cruiser complete with a helicopter pad and an onboard garage for a Ferrari. Supposedly fitted out for the super-elite Mediterranean charter business, the weird thing was that it only ever had one client, Christos Nicolaides, and his entourage of babes, hangers-on, business associates, and bodyguards. All through summer, we kept tabs on the boat by satellite, and while we were in Grozny and Bucharest chasing traders and drug dealers, we watched the endless party glide from Saint-Tropez down to Capri, until finally it pulled into the hollowed-out volcano that forms the harbor at Santorini. And there the vessel stayed, Nicolaides and his guests relocating every day from the boat's huge sun deck up to the town's restaurants and nightclubs and back down again. Meanwhile, half a continent away, I waited on a street corner in Geneva for a phone to be answered. When it did, I said three words to a man sitting in a clifftop cafe. "That you, Reno?" I asked.
"Wrong number," he said, and hung up.
Jean Reno was the name of the actor who played the assassin in the movie Leon, and the team leader sitting in the cafe knew it meant death. He nodded to his colleague, who immediately called the other three agents, who were sitting among milling tourists at other cafes. The five of them rendezvoused just near the beautiful Rastoni bar and restaurant, looking for all the world like a group of affluent European holidaymakers meeting up for lunch. The two women in the squad were the primary shooters, and that, I'm afraid, was my mistake. It was just before 2, the restaurant still crowded, when my so-called holidaymakers walked in. The three men spoke to the harried manager about a table while the women moved to the bar, ostensibly to check their makeup in its mirror, but in fact noting in the reflection the position of every person in the vaulted space. Christos and his posse, three Albanian bodyguards and a clutch of chicks his mother had probably warned him about, were sitting at a table looking straight out at the harbor.
"All set?"
one of our women asked her male colleagues in passable Italian, framing it as a question, but meaning it as a statement. The men nodded. The women had their tote bags open, putting away their lipstick, reaching for their camera cases. They both pulled out stainless steel SIG P-232s and turned in a tight arc. Christos's bodyguards, with their true religion jeans, muscle man t-shirts, and Czech machine pistols, didn't have a chance against real professionals. Two of them didn't even see it coming. The first they heard was the sound of bone breaking as bullets slammed into their heads and chests. The third bodyguard made it to his feet, a strategy which succeeded only in presenting himself as a bigger target for the team leader. Shows how much he knew. The agent hit him with 3 bullets, which was unnecessary, as the first one pretty much blasted his heart out the back of his chest. As is usual in these situations, a lot of people started yelling, to absolutely no effect. One of them was Christos, trying to take command, I guess, scrambling to his feet, reaching under his flapping linen shirt for the Beretta he kept in the waistband of his pants. Like a lot of tough guys who don't do any real training, he thought he was well prepared by keeping the safety catch off. In the panic of a genuine firefight, he pulled the weapon out, put his finger on the trigger, and shot himself through the leg. Fighting the pain and humiliation, he kept turning to face his attackers. What he saw were 2 middle-aged women, feet planted wide, who, had there been a band, looked like they were about to start a strange dance. Instead, they both opened up at 7 yards, 2 rounds each. Most of Christos's vital organs, including his brain, were finished before he dropped. Immediately, the 5 agents sprayed their weapons across the mirrors, creating a lot of impressive noise and maximum panic. Terrified diners sprinted for the doors, a Japanese tourist tried to film it on his phone, and a ricocheting bullet hit a female member of Christos's party in the butt. As one of our women agents told me later, given the way the chick was dressed, the last time she had that much paint up her ass, she was probably getting paid for it. The flesh wound was the only collateral damage. no small achievement given the number of people in the restaurant and the unpredictable nature of any assassination. The agents pocketed their weapons, burst out of the front door amid the exploding panic, and yelled for someone to call the cops. At a prearranged location, a tiny cobblestone square, they regrouped and boarded 4 Vespa scooters, permitted for residents only, but secured earlier in the day by a large payment to a local repair shop. The team sped into the town's narrow alleys, and the leader used a cell phone to call in 2 fast boats waiting in the next bay. In 3 minutes, the assassins reached a scenic cable car that offers an alternative, and far quicker, descent than the donkeys. It takes less than 2 minutes to take the 1,200-foot drop, and already the boats were pulling into the wharf. The team was halfway to the next island, hurtling across the sparkling blue water in a plume of white spray, by the time the first cops arrived at Restoni. To the Greek cops' ribald amusement, they quickly learned that Christos, the firstborn and best-loved son of Patros Nikolaidis, had been gunned down by 2 ladies in capri pants and Chanel sunglasses. And that was my mistake. Not the killing of him, the women. I genuinely hadn't given it a thought, I just sent the best people for the job, but as I have to keep relearning, it's the unquestioned assumptions that get you every time. In the villages of northern Greece, where decisions are taken only in the councils of men, that somebody had assigned women to do the killing was worse in a way than the death itself. It was an insult. For the old man, it was as if the killers were telling him that Christos was such a no-account castrato, he wasn't even worth a matador. Maybe Patros, the ruthless enforcer and father, would have ridden out of his compound for vengeance anyway, but when he learned the circumstances, for his dignity as a man, for his honor, forget that, given his past, he had none of these things, he believed he had no choice. The woman agent was wrong about the other casualty, too. Despite the spandex, she wasn't rented ass at all. She was Christos's younger sister. As I would learn later, for one of the few times in her adult life, she was relatively clean and sober in Restoni. While the other patrons raced for the exits, she scrambled across the shattered glass, bending over her brother, trying to talk him into not dying. Realizing it was failing, she grabbed her cell phone and made a call. Despite all her years of relentless sex, it was to the only real man in her life, her father. As a result, Patros and his phalanx of Albanians heard before I did exactly what my people had wrought that afternoon. I hadn't moved from my corner near the old town when I got a call 10 minutes after he did. It was a text message giving me the price of a Leon DVD on Amazon. It meant Christos was dead, the team was safe on board the boats, there was no sign of pursuit. I put the phone away and looked at my watch. 18 minutes had passed since I had made the call initiating the whole event. In the interim, I'd phoned through orders deploying smaller teams to arrest the other 6 named collaborators, and now the events that started several years ago in Red Square were finally drawing to a close. I suppose I could have taken a moment for quiet congratulation, allowed myself some small feeling of triumph, but I'm prone to self-doubt. Always doubting, I'm afraid. As I adjusted my briefcase, an anonymous young businessman stepping out of the shadows and into the faceless foreign crowd. It was a dead British orator and writer who was on my mind. Edmund Burke said the problem with war is that it usually consumes the very things that you're fighting for. Justice, decency, humanity. And I couldn't help but think of how many times I had violated our nation's deepest values in order to protect them. Lost in thought, I headed for the small bridge that crossed the river. It is 800 paces from the edge of the old town to the hotel in which I was staying. 800 paces, about 4 minutes. In terms of history, not even the blink of an eye, really. And yet in that moment, all our souls were turning in a few madmen's hands. Chapter 13. The Hotel du Rhône was deserted when I walked in. The doorman had gone, the concierge wasn't at his post, and the front desk was unattended. More disturbing was the silence. I called out, and when nobody answered, I made my way to the bar at one side of the lobby. The staff were all there, standing with the patrons, watching a TV screen. It was a few minutes before 3 p.m. in Geneva, 9 a.m. in New York. The date was September the 11th. The first plane had just hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center, and already the footage was being replayed over and over again. A couple of news anchors started speculating that it might be anti-U.S. terrorists, and this theory was met with cheering from several Swiss idiots at the bar. They were speaking French, but my summers in Paris meant I was fluent enough to understand they were praising the courage and ingenuity of whoever was responsible. I thought of the people at home in New York watching the same footage as us, knowing that their loved ones were somewhere in the burning building and desperately praying that somehow they would make it out. Maybe there are worse things than watching your family die on live television, but if there were, I couldn't think of any at that moment. I had a gun in my pocket, all ceramic and plastic, designed to beat metal detectors like the ones at Boucher's office, and I was angry enough to consider using it. As I fought back my emotions, United Airlines Flight 175 out of Boston hit the South Tower. It sent everyone in the room, even the idiots, reeling. My memory is that after an initial scream, the bar was silent, but that may not be true. All I know is I had a terrible sense of worlds colliding, of the Great Republic shifting on its axis. Alone, far from home, I feared nothing would ever be the same again. For the first time in history, some unidentified enemy had taken lives on the continental United States. Not only that, they had destroyed an icon, which in a way represented the nation itself. Ambitious, modern, always reaching higher. Nobody could say how deep the damage would run, but in the bar, life was fractured into disjointed moments. A phone ringing unanswered. A cigar burning to ash. The TV jumping between the immediate past and the terrifying present. And still, people weren't talking. Maybe even the idiots were wondering, like me, if there was more to come. Where would it end? The White House? 3 Mile Island? I left the gun in my pocket, pushed through the crowd that had gathered unnoticed behind me, and went up in an empty elevator to my room. I put a call through to Washington, first on a conventional landline connected out of London, and then via the Pine Gap satellite, but all communications on the east coast of the United States were collapsing under the weight of traffic. Finally, I called an NSA relay station in Peru, gave them the Rider of the Blues priority code, and got through to the division on an emergency satellite network. I spoke to the director on a connection so hollow it sounded like we were having a conversation in a toilet bowl, and asked him to send a plane so I could get back, wanting to know how I could help. He said there was nothing I could do, and anyway, he just heard from the National Security Council. All flights in and out of the country were about to be halted. I should sit tight. Nobody knew where this damn thing was going. It wasn't so much what he said that scared me. It was the edge of panic in his voice. He said he had to go. His building was being evacuated, and so was the White House. I put the phone down and turned on the TV. Anybody who was alive that terrible day knows what happened. People leaping hand in hand from God knows what height. The collapse of the two towers. The dust and apocalyptic scenes in Lower Manhattan. In houses, offices, and war rooms across the world, people were seeing things they would never forget. Sorrow floats. And though I wouldn't discover it for a long time, watching the cops and firefighters rushing into what would become their concrete tomb, there was one person who saw, in that whirlwind of chaos, the opportunity of a lifetime. She was one of the smartest people I have ever encountered, and despite my many affairs with other substances, intelligence has always been my real drug. For that reason alone, I will never forget her. Whatever people may think of the morality, there was no doubt it took a kind of genius to start planning the perfect murder in the maelstrom of September the 11th, and then carry it out a long time later in a scummy little hotel called the East Side Inn. While she was laying her dark plans, I spent the evening watching people jump until, by 10 p.m. in Geneva, the crisis itself was winding down. The president was flying back to Washington from a bunker at Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. The fire at the Pentagon was under control, and the first bridges into Manhattan were being reopened. At about the same time, I got a call from an aide at the National Security Council who told me the government had intelligence pointing to a Saudi national, Osama bin Laden, and that attacks against his bases in Afghanistan